Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM. My name's Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. Today my guest is Nikki Smith. Nikki is the author of Look What You Made Me Do, out in paperback now. It's a twisty psychological thriller, the follow-up to her debut, All in Her Head, which was described by Harriet Tice as tense and moving. So let's hear what Nikki has to say about Look What You Made Me Do. Hi, Nikki. Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM.
Hi, Paul. It's lovely to be here.
Well, let's start with going back to the beginning, actually, and when you first wanted to be a writer. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I guess, I did English at university many, many years ago, and I always wanted to be an author. I love the kind of creative writing side of it. I mean, it was English literature that I did at university, so it was reading rather than writing, but I still like the kind of writing side of it. And I tried writing a book after I left university, and looking back on it, it was rubbish. It's sitting in my loft somewhere, I think on some kind of like CD-ROM type drive disc thing, and it won't ever come out and see the light of day. So I sent it off, and I had a bit of agent interest, but nothing, didn't go any further than that. And at that point, I knew nothing about the publishing industry. I had no idea what I was doing. So I just left it. I just thought, this isn't for me. I'm not going to be an author. And I pursued a completely different career in finance, actually ended up working as an accountant. And then following that, worked in various different places, worked in a bank. I've been kind of head of finance for a trampoline park, interestingly.
Right.
And then about 5 years ago, somebody who I was in at school with, who I hadn't seen since I left, so for like 20 odd years, contacted me on Facebook, and she asked me how I was, and also asked if I'd ever done anything with my writing, as she still remembered the stories that I used to read out when we were at school together. And I had written, I'd carried on writing, but only stuff for me, nothing that I'd showed anybody. So it was a bit of a now or never moment. And I took the plunge. I signed up for a creative writing course with Curtis Brown, who are a literary agency in London.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was just a kind of 6 week course, the first one that I did. I just kind of dipped my toe in the water to see whether I'd like it or not. And then I applied for a longer course, which was a bit more selective, and I managed to get a place. And in those 3 months, it was an online course because I still had a full-time job. And in kind of very early mornings and late evenings, I wrote the first draft of what was going to become my debut novel.
Right, lovely. Well, that's a good summary of things. I wanted to look at a couple of details in there, though. Was it sort of disillusion that led you to stop the writing or to stop trying to get published, let's say? Or was it just a realization that really you weren't ready in a sense?
I think it was probably more disillusion. I just thought it was an industry that you could either kind of be in or you couldn't be in. And I think it was probably also a bit of naivety on my part that I didn't realize that authors kind of, when they write something, it's not just as simple as writing that first draft and sending it off. You actually have to spend the vast majority of your time editing your work and kind of getting it into a shape that's going to be decent enough to be published. I think I was very young and probably didn't actually have that much to say at that point in my life either. But also was just, naive. I wrote one draft and thought, okay, well, that's it. I reached the end. Let's go. Let's press send. And expected somehow some kind of miracle that that would be in a suitable form to become published. And obviously it wasn't. So, yeah, I think it was a mixture of factors.
Yeah. Necessary step in a way, though, isn't it? You've got to get these things out of your system in a sense.
Absolutely.
Who were you always a big reader?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
It's surprising, but occasionally somebody says the opposite. I've been taking it for granted, and apparently you can't, not even with writers. So who would you say did inspire you, or who was it that you looked up to and made you think, I want to be a writer?
I think, I mean, probably the first person I read that made me feel like that was Stephen King. Right. I mean, I started reading his books, you know, when I was, you know, I don't know, 12, 13, something like that. And I zipped through them all, you know, The Shining and Carrie and, you know, that kind of thing. So I just loved, I mean, obviously I know they're, most of them are horror, but it's not really the horror aspect. I think it was his characters that, you know, that just kind of carry you through a story. I just thought that was, they were fabulous. So I guess, in the early days, it was somebody like him. And then kind of, you know, obviously in the last kind of, I don't know, 10 years, all kinds of people, but, you know, I've loved Claire McIntosh's books, Gillian Flynn, Sarah Pinborough, Rosamund Lupton. Yes, too many to mention, but yeah.
No, but it gives us an idea, doesn't it? And it's, I can see how some of the leaning towards the writing that you do, you know, and that's interesting. So you went on to this career in finance, which I think actually we may have a sort of shared experience here. You know, I do this now and I really enjoy it. I worked in industry, I worked in the government sector and all sorts of things. And I wasn't unhappy, but it's not fully rewarding. What it is though, and I think from a writer's point of view, I'm assuming, is that it gives you that life experience. So was that sort of crucial then when you come back to writing that you've got that behind you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just kind of working in that type of industry, as you say, or any other industry, you know, you learn about deadlines for a start. You know, I think I'm quite kind of business orientated, very practical in terms of, you know, if somebody asks me to do something and I commit to doing it within a certain time, I'll do it. And just that kind of life experience, you learn, you know, you just learn so much, don't you? I think that, it's nothing is wasted, I think. And you know, there's all kinds of things that I've learned in my day-to-day life, working life, that I can then use in books later on, which I think is also useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you moved on to the writing and you mentioned there, you did the Curtis Brown Creative Writing course. I mean, tell us about that, actually. Tell us a little bit about it and what it does, you know, how that helps you as a writer, if you like.
Well, I think, I mean, I know that they run lots of courses. They did when I kind of did them, but I think they've probably expanded their range even now. So I signed up initially. I think it was about £200 for a 6-week online course. Anybody could do it. My husband bought it for me, actually, as a Christmas present. I asked nicely. It was a kind of, tell me what you want for Christmas and I'll have this, please. And it was purely online. So it enabled me to do it, you know, as and when you have to follow a certain structure, but, you know, you can do it in the evenings or as and when, you know, around a job, basically. And I think it was a couple of things it taught me, really. One was it gave me a lot of information about how the industry worked, which I had, you know, especially coming from a background in finance. I wasn't a journalist, you know, I didn't have any idea about how publishing worked. So it taught me, you know, that you need to get an agent, that, you know, it's that agent that will then get you, hopefully, you know, a publishing deal, and how to approach those agents, what they want to see in a synopsis and a covering letter, you know, what kind of stage your book should be at. And also it gave me the experience to kind of in a kind of environment where you can put your work out to other writers who are on the course. We each had to kind of stick up a piece of writing and then, cover your eyes when everybody comes back and critiques it. So that was, and obviously you have to critique other people's. I found that really worthwhile because it does enable you to see what other people see in your writing. You know, the mistakes that you're making. I think, you know, my writing, you know, certainly at the beginning had far too many adverbs in, and, you know, things like that. And just little things like that, that I think will help you improve as a writer. But for me, I think the best thing was just learning about the industry.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting though. I mean, it's a brave thing to do actually, isn't it? To put your work in front of people like that. But of course it is necessary because that can't happen at the point where you suddenly reach readers. It wouldn't make any sense.
So, absolutely, yeah.
Was it always a thriller, sort of psychological novel that was in your mind? You know, or in fact, let's start more basic than that. Did you have something specific in mind when you went back to writing, or was it the idea of writing a novel that was sort of the general thing?
I think when I did the six-week course, I didn't have any particular idea what right. I wanted to write. I mean, I knew I wanted to write in a psychological thriller genre, put it that way. Right. I knew that's what I wanted to do. That's the books that I've always read. Mm. That's what interests me. But I didn't have a specific idea. But when I applied for the kind of three-month course, which was much later, it was like kind of 6 to 8 months after I did the first course, that's when I had the idea. And I think it had really been sitting in my subconscious for quite a long time, but that's the time when I kind of, pulled it out and kind of put it into some kind of format that was, readable.
So if we talk about that first novel then, All in Her Head, just a little bit before we get on to Look What You Made Me Do, which of course is why we're here, because that's just coming out in paperback. I just wonder with that debut, I mean, it's about motherhood and it's about the trauma around motherhood as a theme sort of, backing the story. I'm just wondering how much you drew on your personal experience for that.
Yes, it's interesting. I think I read somewhere that somebody had said that every author's debut novel is to some extent autobiographical. And yeah. And at the time, I you know, if you'd have asked me that, I'd have said, no, it's not. I think, there's definitely elements in there. I've got two daughters. They're old now, one's 16 and one's 14. So, right. It's a long time since they were little. But I had a particularly traumatic birth with my second child and ended up in intensive care in hospital and lost kind of 3 liters of blood and it was pretty traumatic. She was a rather large baby, so physically I could kind of really identify with what one of my characters was going through. Mentally, touch wood, I think I was very lucky. I've never suffered from anything mm-hmm. that my characters in the book did. So from that point of view, I had to do a lot of research to find out about that particular condition. I think you draw on your own experiences to a certain extent, but my character is definitely fictional and not me.
No, absolutely. I see that point. The thing about it is, though, that books are about empathy, aren't they? There's no,
absolutely,
no
yes.
added value to it.
Yes.
Was it a cathartic experience for you, though?
I think actually it was. Definitely. I didn't write the book specifically for that reason anything like that. But I think having written it, there's definitely some scenes in the book that kind of come out on the page that were quite cathartic to write. And I've had quite a few readers have contacted me since the book came out, the first one, and who have suffered from what my kind of central character suffers from. And they said they feel it was very sensitively done and they really empathised with it and really felt for her. So hopefully I got it right, because that was very important to me.
Yeah, I'm sure. And actually, that sounds great, because if you think in a way that it can help people, that'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? It's
absolutely.
One of those things that it's bizarre sometimes when you get these problems that are so huge in society and we find out that we're only just sort of discovering them, or, people are putting it to the side and just ignoring it, which is mostly what we did with the issues that come around postpartum stress and illness.
Absolutely.
We just didn't want to know about it. It's like one of those uncomfortable
yes.
things. Anyway, that isn't the subject of your second book, which is Look What You Made Me Do. So this is a really good time to tell people a little bit about the book, I think.
Okay. Look What You Made Me Do is my second novel. And I guess it's really about toxic relationships and the dark secrets that lie beneath the surface of a seemingly perfect family. It's about two sisters, Jo and Caroline, who are both in their late 30s. And the book opens when their father, Thomas, has just sadly died. And it turns out that he has left his entire inheritance to his younger child, Jo. So Jo and Caroline have had a rather awkward relationship growing up. Jo's always felt that Caroline has been the kind of favoured sister by her mother. And so we're left with the situation where Jo has inherited all this money, and the question is, how far will Caroline go to get what Jo now has?
Indeed. That's a nice summary, so we can take it from there. So let's start with the fact that it is about the two sisters, And I'm just wondering, did you feel that the bond between the siblings sort of gave an added oomph to the story, if you like? I mean, what is it about sisters, in a sense, that bond? Because we're going to get into an awful lot of areas here where we can't really talk about the plot. Which actually, yeah, that's very true. You know, that's a few questions that can't be put directly. But that bond is crucial in the story, if you like, and perhaps not in the way, in the obvious way that some people might think. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yes. I mean, I don't have a sister. I've got a brother. Right. I'm a younger brother. He's 5 years younger than me. So I've never been in that kind of sibling relationship with a sister. But I think that, you know, female relationships are kind of, you know, can be incredibly close, but also incredibly complicated. And yeah. And that's why I think, especially in families, I think that, you know, we've all been in situations where, you know, sometimes you really get on with your siblings and there are other times when you don't, and there can be kind of tensions between you. And I think that that's all often brought to a height in a family situation where everything can look great on the surface, but actually underneath it's not. So that's something that I wanted to kind of explore, and just how those two women kind of felt about each other, you know, when they've grown up and there's kind of misunderstandings as to, yeah, who gets on best with their parents and who doesn't, and yeah, the fallout from that.
Yeah, because that's really interesting. It gets us into a whole lot of areas. When we talk about their relationship and the relationship with the family, which is for both sisters sort of up and down over time, but it's about their perspectives. And we, you know, you involve the readers in the story by having the two separate perspectives. What was it like writing it that way? And explain why you did that.
I think with all my books, I really like getting inside the characters' heads. So, and I think that so much of life, you know, when you have those relationships that become kind of toxic, if you like, so much of it is to do with misunderstandings, you know, and how one person interprets what another person is doing, as opposed to, you know, the actual action itself. And so I wanted my readers to identify with both women. And, you know, there isn't a kind of, you know, a good character and a bad character, if you like. It's their, they're both just people, and they're both inherently flawed. And I wanted people to see those flaws and how the other character then relates to that. So hopefully, yeah, people will feel empathy for both characters.
Yeah, as you say, it does come down to that interpretation. And they are both flawed characters, but it is this misunderstanding, is a good way of putting it, you know, how things develop, but with memory, things are not necessarily the way they were. It's not like the past is a real thing in that sense. And you wind up with the two sisters sort of misinterpreting each other. And that's what we get to unpick as a reader, which is really brilliant.
Yes.
Memory is a really, it's a complex thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. And I think that if you took one particular situation and put kind of 10 people who watched the same event, each of them would have a very different recollection of what actually happened. Even if they were asked kind of a minute afterwards, you know, they'd probably come up with the same basic scenario, but everybody would notice something different. And I think that's what happens, you know, in families when people are kind of growing up and incidents happen, everybody takes something different away from that and it can kind of grow into something bigger. So,
yeah, which I think is getting to this point about, I mean, whether we really ever know anybody.
Absolutely.
Those silences cause that problem. But the other thing that very much struck me about this is that what's passed on, or the past, is it's not so much about events, although they start this off. It's more about an emotional weight that gets carried forward. So what you're bringing of the past is that weight, that pain and suffering and things like that. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yes.
So people always talk about twists in psychological thrillers in particular. And I'm not against, you know, I love a good twist as much as anybody else does. I think it can sometimes be overdone and that there are nice twists in your book. It's not so much that that's the heart of the book, I think. It's more the shift in the story, if you like, the narration. You know, because you've set out a premise and you did it when you talked about what the book's about. And the book is absolutely about that, but that's a tiny fraction. It's the surface layer, if you like. It's a much more nuanced kind of thing, much more complex. Did you conceive it that way? This again is, you see, this is what I was saying about you can't really talk about the plot. I can't really say what I'm trying to hint
absolutely.
At.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. I mean, yes, I mean, certainly, I think, yeah, we talk about the themes of the book, yes. And yes, there's definitely kind of coercive control in there, I guess, which is, you know, about those toxic relationships. But, and I think I had that kind of forefront in my mind when I started thinking about what to write. I mean, I think that I completely agree with you that I think nowadays, one of the issues, I guess, with psychological thrillers is that everybody has, you know, the twist that you won't see coming kind of plastered across the front of their mm-hmm. book. So I think my debut novel, it does have a huge twist in it, which was mm-hmm. why it was always very difficult to kind of talk about. I think it was Jake Kerridge who said in one of his, when he reviewed it, he said, it, you know, it's a twist that hits you like an express train or something, which was very nice. But I think readers are often, you know, they're just a bit bored by that, I think, mm-hmm. now, because everybody has a twist that you don't see coming or a twist that you won't see coming. So I think with this book, I wanted to kind of move slightly away from that. I mean, as you say, there is something that happens at the end of the book, which a lot of people have yes. commented on as a kind of like, ooh, moment, but it wasn't so much of a twist. It's just, you know, it hopefully kind of just, yeah, ramps up the tension a bit and then, yeah, leaves people, you know, with an unexpected ending, I would say. So, yeah, I think I started off this one. I mean, it's a second novel anyway, and obviously it's very different from writing a debut where you've had kind of years to think about the idea and you've written it and rewritten it and rewritten it. And then suddenly I had a 2-book contract. So, you know, you're suddenly on a time pressure of, right, you've got to get this next one written and out in a year. So I started off with, yeah, the theme that I wanted to write about, really, which is kind of coercive control. That I find that topic completely fascinating and horrific. And so that's where I kind of started from. And then the idea kind of grew outwards from there.
Yeah, I would like to talk about that, actually, but we'll get onto that a little bit later, the coercive control issue. So this was your second novel. Did you suffer from second novel syndrome?
Yes, most definitely. Yes, I mean, I'm part of a group on Facebook called the D20s, which all got together, yeah, when at the start of the pandemic, because we were all being published in 2020 when COVID hit. So yeah, my debut came out. I actually saw it roll off the presses in about the 16th of March, went up to Clay's and saw it kind of literally roll off the presses, and right. then it rolled straight into a warehouse because it was published on the 2nd of April. So we obviously went into lockdown on the 23rd of March. So yeah, not the greatest of timing. Yes, and we've talked a lot in our group actually about the second novel and how tricky it is to write. And I would definitely agree with that. I think that it was just a very different experience, I think, to writing a debut because of that time pressure. And I think that you have a tendency to think, well, I've written one novel, you know, it's you know, how hard can it be to write a second? And the answer is very hard. And so, yes. But I got through it with the help of a very lovely editor at Orion. And so, yeah, I'm very pleased with how the book ended up, but it was definitely difficult, I think, to write it. I kind of did one draft and then kind of basically rewrote it the second time, which was, yeah, it's always tricky when that happens. But it's there and it's out. So
it is, absolutely. Yeah, so right, talking about the second novel then, would you say you've got that style and your routine and everything set now?
No. Definitely not. I think writing it during the pandemic is just such a weird experience. I had both my kids off school because everybody was homeschooling, so my entire routine kind of changed. I like to have a quiet house and headspace, but that was obviously impossible. So it yeah, it was just very different, because I can often, before that, I was kind of, my kids would get dropped off at school, and then I could come back and have a good chunk of the day to write in kind of silence. I guess I'm very lucky like that, on the days that I'm not kind of doing another job, but it just wasn't like that at all. It was just kind of fitting things in around, you know, an hour here, an hour there if I was lucky, and very early mornings and evenings. So yeah, I'm hoping that I don't have to do that again, because it was reasonably painful experience. But yeah, we'll see. We'll have to see what the next year brings. So
now, I'm always amazed when authors say that. You know, I've heard young mothers say, well, you know, I fitted in 20 minutes here and 20 minutes there. And you honestly think, could I do that? You know, and would I come up with something sensible at the end of it? I don't know.
Yes.
Anyway, I have to admire that quality in writers to be able to do that.
Yes, I think it was a lot of zoning out. My kids would be kind of like, mom, hello. Yes.
Mind you,
sorry, I'm just writing, just writing.
Yeah, that's a skill you have to learn as a parent anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So with the dual perspectives, I wonder, I think I heard something you said about your first novel where you kind of split them off again. You split the narrative paths off. Did you do that with this book?
No, I didn't so right. much. I think, yeah, I mean, my first novel, I initially wrote it the very, very, very early drafts. It was all from the point of view of one character. And that changed completely because it's ended up as a dual narrative.
Yes, right.
Between like Alison and Jack. But this novel, no, I kind of wrote it much more in a kind of linear fashion, I guess. So it was just, yeah, one chapter and then another. And then so you could see the kind of different perspectives. But I kind of just flipped in and out of people's heads as opposed to kind of doing it in one go and then splitting it up. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I have a large spreadsheet.
Well, that's interesting. We'll talk about that, actually, because you do have this thing where you've got the, let's talk about the backstory first, actually, because I think it's relevant to what we were just talking about there. Do you create an awful lot more backstory than you actually use effectively?
Absolutely. Yes.
Because then you get these two characters, and when they come together, you sort of, like you said, you've got Joe and you say, well, Joe thinks this. And then you go to Caroline and you think, well, Caroline thinks this about that, and it's not the same as Joe. It's really interesting. So you can't be precious then about the kind of stuff you leave in your book, in a sense.
Yes. Yes. I think that, that's probably, I mean, definitely that's one of the things I learned about writing my debut is initially you just want to put it all in the book. You want to put everything down that you've kind of thought of to, you know, you think it's going to make your characters full and wholesome if they can, the reader can hear all these little kind of backstories and what led them to this point. But you actually, I think that is something that comes with experience, is that that all doesn't need to get on the page. And in fact, your editor will probably cross most of that out and it'll be like, we don't need to know that. And you need to know it in your head to be able to write them and to be able to understand what your characters are like, but the reader doesn't necessarily need to see that on the page. And I think a successful writer has ways of being able to kind of impart things about their characters without needing to give the whole backstory, but the reader still ends up at the same place when they're reading about that particular character.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also it's kind of pace and sort of thrills kind of are the opposite, aren't they, in a sense? And so if you
Absolutely.
Don't balance them, you wind up possibly driving the readers a bit, well,
yes, completely
slowing everything down, which would be a terrible thing to do, really.
Yes, I think it's only when I think that's something I learned as well, is just when you're reading it back, often if you suddenly jump into a flashback, it does slow the pace down completely and it can take the reader out of the story. They always have to be moving forward, I think, in crime and thrillers. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. It's not a particularly interesting read.
You mentioned plotting there and how you have these spreadsheets and hangover from the financial world, I assume.
It is.
But when you've done that and you plot it down and you color code and so on, how much do you actually stick to that? I mean, does it doesn't work that way, does it, in real life?
No. I mean, I I'd say, I mean, yeah, I would say, I mean, my first novel, my debut, I didn't kind of plot so much like that at all. But mm-hmm. I think it's taken me so long to write, you know, by the time I got to the final version that I was kind of doing it, but like subconsciously, but obviously with a much stricter time deadline, I kind of thought, right, that, you know, how are we going to do this? So the way that I do it is I have a spreadsheet. I mean, other people use post-it notes. You hear about all kinds of different things. My post-it notes don't seem to stick on my walls very well here. They fall off on the ground. So I tend to like have it on a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And then I will just kind of outline the plot. It's not everything that happens at all. And I'm one of these people where things do change, definitely. So the second half of the book, I might know what's going to happen in the end. I tend to know what's going to happen in the end, but how I get there will definitely change, because you just get to know your characters better as you're writing, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, you really got to feel that you would know them if they walked into a room with 10 other people. Otherwise, the reader won't know them. So, but I at least kind of outline roughly where I'm going, you know, even if it's just a sentence on each kind of chapter. So I think that makes me feel more comfortable about it when I'm writing, because I think I know where I'm going, and then you can just kind of change it as you go. But I think that there is something definitely, you know, color coding, and I think there's an app called Scrivener, which I've never been, and I did have a go, but I wasn't for me. But I think that you can highlight different characters in different colors and things. Mm-hmm. And I think that that helps when you're looking at the outline. You know, if you've got one character, say, in red and the other one in green, you know, if your whole wall looks red and there's no green, then you've gone wrong somewhere. Yeah. It's that kind of thing that can be helpful when it's just plotted out like that in front of you.
Yeah, very simple things in a way, but when you can point them up, obviously, like that, it really clearly shows you what you've got to work
on. Yeah. And timelines, I think spreadsheets are really good for timelines, because you can get yourself into such a muddle if you, you know, if there's certain things happening in a particular order. And I think, you know, in my books, it is kind of jumping in and out of things that you need to know exactly when things happen, so that especially when you're editing, if you had changed one thing, well, what impact is that going to have all the way through the book? It's easy to see if it's all on a spreadsheet. Yeah.
So back to themes, you mentioned the coercive control, and one of the big things about your book is around domestic abuse, or abuse in general, let's say. This is always one that, if you ask critics, they'll sometimes say there are too many books on the subject. I don't think that's true. I think what they think there are too many of are books that are pretty samey or have this twist, but they don't honestly have the real emotional heart of the books. For me, I think this is one of those areas where, given it's the major problem in society, you know, the one that affects most people more often than anything else, it's crazy that this is the crime that's least talked about. So, I mean, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, even now, two women are still dying every week at the hands of their partners, which is just a horrific statistic in the UK. And as you say, you know, it is common, I know that. And so it might not seem a particularly, you know, exciting thing to write about, because we've all heard about it before, but it's still going on. And that's the thing. And I think that people just don't realise how easy it is to hide, I think, that kind of abuse that's going on, even from members of your, you know, members of your close family. I think that a lot of people are just unaware that it's happening to people that they know, or it will be, you know, and to friends and things, because I think a lot of women are still embarrassed by it and ashamed of it, and they don't really like to admit that it's happening. And also that it doesn't have to be physical necessarily. That's what I wanted to get across. It's not so much the physicality of, although that's obviously horrific in itself, that's happening. It's just the insidiousness of the abuse and how terrifying that can be, whether or not it ends up with something physical happening to them.
No, I know it's one of those things that it seems almost the wrong way around to put it, but it is kind of, it's subtle.
Absolutely.
You know, the way that it grows and becomes something so terrible within a relationship. So no, I mean, for me, I think one of the exciting things about crime fiction is the idea that it is a social commentary.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
And, on that basis, I love the idea that we're having more victim-centered sort of crime fiction, because that's more real at the end of the day. It is, yes, much more real to the world. And that, you know, I'd be much more interested in reading that. I don't think we should leave people on that kind of point, though. So let's lighten up a little bit. I'm just wondering, do you enjoy the nuts and bolts of laying down the clues and the odd red herring or two? I mean, even in a serious topic, you know, there's this, it is a thriller and it has to have these certain rules and things.
Absolutely. Yes. 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 I do really enjoy that. Yeah. I think that I think the best things for me about writing are when something kind of occurs to you as you're kind of going along. You might have had this great idea and you kind of know what the middle is and you know what the end of the story is, but just every now and again something will happen that you hadn't thought of before, and right. As you're writing and you'll suddenly think, oh yeah, that's good. And it's those little things that I think, well, if I can't see that coming and I'm writing it, then hopefully the reader won't be able to see it either. So I like clues and, you know, the misdirection and setting up red herrings and things like that. But often that comes, I think, just as I'm writing. It's difficult to think about those things in advance. You know, I think when you're plotting, you can't think, I'm going to make them think this. And then, I mean, no. in a big way you can, but not the little things as you're going through. Yeah.
No, I think that makes sense. And it's better that way, because the whole thing about a book is it has to be organic anyway. You know, if you read it and you can tell somebody plotted it all out and thought, oh, this sentence has to be here, then, you know, it's not going to be much of an enjoyable read.
Exactly. Yes.
So
yes.
One of the things when we talk to writers is always that I'm talking about the book which is coming out now in paperback, which is Look What You Made Me Do. You, of course, did that quite a while ago. And so what are you on to now?
Well, I've just finished my book three, actually, and that is currently with my agent. Right. So we shall see what she thinks about it. I can't really tell you anything about it, except that it's another psychological thriller, similar genre. And hopefully she'll like it. So
the third book.
And it definitely wasn't as traumatic to write as book two. So, yes.
All right. Okay.
Yes.
And just one last question then. Who would you recommend a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a crime story for that matter, by the way.
Oh,
do you get much time for reading? That's another question, because obviously, you know, with the writing, it obviously is. And you said you make the point, you've got to fit that in around having children and all the rest of it too, mind.
Absolutely, yes. But no, I love reading, and I do read psychological fiction more than anything else. So I've recently read Fiona Cumming's When I Was 10.
Right.
I love that. That's exactly, you know, that's the type of genre that I guess I like to read. I have recently read a book, I'm sent quite a lot of proofs as well, a lovely part of the job, I guess. And I've recently read Jack Jordan's one, which is coming out in 2022, called Do No Harm, which, if you like very pacey thrillers, that's definitely one for you. It was great. Good read.
All right. Okay. Lovely. Well, I'll make a note of that. Nikki, that's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much, Paul. That was lovely.
Well, thank you, Nikki Smith. That was a really enjoyable chat. And thank you for listening. I'll be back with another interview very shortly. But for now, bye.